Taiwan, we're talking about it. Maggie Lewis is a professor at Seton Hall Law School, and Lev Nachman is a PhD student at UC Irvine. So, I hear you guys went out to dinner with 25 people last night?
We definitely had a full crew. We definitely tried to take advantage of the fact that we're able to go out without having to have a mask on close to other people.
Yeah, just stop. Basis, okay, just stop. Stop. We can't. It's too painful. I hear, though, that there was some, like, evil pilot from Australia. Like, what's the deal with the new outbreak you guys have?
That was actually different. There was a pilot. I think he was actually from New Zealand. Yes. So I don't want to make the Australians feel like they're taking responsibility for what people from New Zealand are doing. He did not follow the rules, which are already modified for pilots. And in fact, it seems there was someone he very much wanted to visit other than his spouse while here. So that happened in December. That was a very limited cluster. But then more recently, there was another very small cluster in Taoyuan.
So I think that in total, they've had 12 or 14 people catch COVID from that cluster. But it really seems like it's already under control.
I think there's been 12 in my floor of my apartment building. But anyways, let's kick us off with some Biden transition talk. What is the new administration looking to do with respect to the U.S.-Taiwan relationship?
Yeah, I mean, there's been a lot of action in the last few weeks. It feels like it was longer than just, 2 weeks ago that we had declaring null and void by the Trump administration of contact policies that have been in place for a long time. And what we're seeing so far, again, we're all of, 9 days into the Biden administration, is more continuity than change with respect to Taiwan policy. We had, most importantly, this statement that was released in response to the increase in air traffic in the Taiwan Strait by PLA jets, in which the United States made clear that the commitment to Taiwan was, quote, rock solid, and also referring back to the Taiwan Relations Act, the three communiques, six assurances, which reiterated the basis of the One China policy and made clear that there wasn't going to be any major shift, at least right now.
And I think what really matters there is that there was so much concern leading up to Biden that there was going to be these fundamental changes of returning to an Obama-era U.S.-Taiwan relation in which the U.S. is much more passive and which we kind of move away from the direction that the Trump administration had pushed the U.S.-Taiwan relation. And, you know, even though, you know, like Maggie said, we're only 9 days in, but at the very least, it feels like there has been a big sigh of relief, both in the U.S. and in Taiwan, when you see statements like this and support from the Biden administration early on, including things like, you know, inviting Xiao Bingqing, the de facto ambassador, to Biden's inauguration. You know, these are signs that, you know, it's early, but it seems positive.
Yeah,
so far.
It's interesting because the sort of general dynamic of the Trump administration was the president unable to care less about the future of Taiwan, while various staffers at different levels wanting to do things go much further in making explicit the commitment that the U.S. has to Taiwanese sovereignty. And there was a plenty of coverage in Taiwanese media about how, you know, Biden is going to lead to the end of the world, which is interesting because, I feel more comfortable trusting him in a time of crisis than I would necessarily with Trump. So to see the sort of roiling water settling down a little bit, at least within the sort of Taiwanese media ecosystem, is a really interesting thing to follow.
Yeah, you know, the presidential election was stressful watching it here because there was just this absolute unabashed bias towards Trump. I by no means judge, Taiwanese voters who say positive things about Trump or see Trump in a positive light. His administration did things that were beneficial to Taiwan. And, you know, Taiwan, who exists in this kind of constant existential crisis of fearing invasion all the time, the logic of the enemy of my enemy is my friend appeals to people here. I disagree with that logic, and I think it's pretty faulty. But Maggie said, when you have fighter jets flying over on a daily basis, it makes, you know, some of Trump's policies seem much more appealing. And it's not that people were opposed to someone else. It's more just fear of losing the stronger relationship that the U.S. had built up with Taiwan. So, you know, when I say the collective sigh really happened, it really felt, especially the day that Xiao Bingqing was at Biden's inauguration. So many of my friends here who are adamant Trump supporters suddenly changed their tone. And now you have people who were like, oh, Biden's going to be the end of Taiwan. Even you know, some of these pages that share just tons of disinformation about the U.S. election actually said nice things about Biden, saying, oh, well, maybe we could give this guy a chance. This is actually okay. So that, you know, it's good. You know, one commentator said that, you know, they're hopeful that, you know, months from now, no one's going to be talking about whether or not we can trust Biden, and people are just going to naturally trust Biden, which I think and hope is going to be true.
To what extent does it matter that the Taiwanese electorate feels confidence in a U.S. president? Like, how would losing that confidence end up impacting the way politicians think, and I guess the way that, you know, maybe the mainland thinks about this issue?
Last year, in the end of 2019, Pew put out their very first survey that they had done in Taiwan that asked Taiwanese people how they feel about the U.S. relationship and about the China relationship. And unsurprisingly, people in Taiwan feel very positive about the U.S.-Taiwan relationship and feel much more critical about the Taiwan-China relationship. Part of my initial concern with kind of how clear support was for Trump in Taiwan was, you know, my line of thinking was, what's this going to do with those numbers that we just, you know, got from Pew that said that people feel really confident and comfortable with the U.S.-Taiwan relationship if they don't have faith in the future U.S. president? You know, most countries that are democracies, you know, people that are elected have to listen and respond to their constituencies here. It's in Taiwan's best interest to stay bipartisan and to be supportive of both parties. And there was concern that, you know, if the Taiwanese voters see one politician or at least one party as much more negative for Taiwan, that might actually have a negative impact on the future of U.S.-Taiwan relations. Now, thankfully, again, it seems like that's not going to happen. And, you know, I know a lot of Taiwanese feel very helpless in this situation because, you know, they have no say in who the U.S. president is. But at the same time, you know, there are things that I think Taiwanese politicians can do to help, you know, maintain relations with both parties, build relationships with both parties. You know, the de facto ambassador Xiao Bingqing is really wonderful in how much she's been trying to create more space for Taiwan in D.C., take meetings with politicians. I'm really hopeful that, you know, in the next 4 years that she's going to be meeting with as many Democrats as she has been meeting with Republicans during the Trump administration. You know, Xiao in particular, being Taiwanese American, speaks, you know, perfect English and Mandarin. So she's kind of a perfect ambassador for Taiwan at the time.
It's interesting kind of comparing this experience to the Israeli one, in that, you know, the vast majority of the, you know, Bibi was way louder about his support for Trump, both, I mean, he did this even for Mitt Romney in 2012, but in 2016 and in 2020 as well. And the Taiwanese leadership, even though you see these newspaper headlines screaming and, you know, all this disinformation about how Biden is Satan's spawn or whatever coming out, they seem like they've been better at holding their tongue, particularly when it comes to doing the sort of things which, you know, could be construed as like actively trying to shape the way politics would go out in terms of, like, you know, mobilizing, you know, Taiwanese American voters or what have you.
No, and President Tsai is an extremely thoughtful and cautious person. She is, my sense is, very aware that everything she has repercussions. And so this is not a situation where you have the head of state making clear there's a preference for one party over another.
So the interesting thing that I think Taiwan and Israel do have in common is that they both still manage to be seen as bipartisan in the U.S. You still have Democrats who vote very strongly with Israel, even though you have people like Bibi who overtly supports Republicans and appeals much more to a conservative Republican base than he bothers to with Democrats as much these days. And Taiwan, you know, Tsai Ing-wen, like Maggie said, she's way too smart and practical to try to pull something like that. And, you know, this is maybe one of the biggest misunderstandings that a lot of, you know, people see about Tsai Ing-wen. She is perhaps the most moderate, willing to be safe and not put Taiwan in a risky situation type of president Taiwan could ever have. And she's not going to put Taiwan at unnecessary risk, nor does she want to jeopardize or put the U.S.-Taiwan relationship at unnecessary risk. So doing something like overtly supporting one party or one politician is not something she would do, and I highly doubt that's something she would have anyone representing her in the U.S. do.
You guys have this riff that Western media spends way too much time thinking about Taiwan in the context of, you know, U.S.-China cross-strait relations type stuff. So I'm going to indulge you in that by spending the rest of the episode just talking about domestic Taiwanese politics. First off, Lev, aside from, like, serious reasons to care about Taiwanese politics, like, what's fun about following it?
Taiwan, at the end of the day, what I think people miss out on is, you know, obviously there's this giant existential question about, you know, who is Taiwan? Where is Taiwan? But, you know, during non-election years, and when, there is, you know, peaceful days, people go about their everyday lives, and like every other functioning democracy in the world.
How many functioning democracies are there in the world now? No.
Fewer and fewer, depending on who you ask. The how we measure the status of democracies is going to be something that plagues political scientists forever after Trump. But you know, there's so much that can be learned from Taiwan, specifically because of how it developed its democratic institutions, the type of democratic institutions it has, like the way that elections are held in Taiwan, how it compares to other East Asian democracies like South Korea or Japan. As someone who studies social movements, protests, and political parties, you know, Taiwanese people are extremely politically active and unafraid to voice those opinions and concerns publicly. And so for someone like me that's very interested in seeing how people participate in politics, Taiwan is a really, really wonderful case study that is rich with data and lots of people willing to tell me their thoughts and opinions about the
cool.
world.
Let's start out with pork. Why is pork making political headlines?
Yeah, rapto pork, which always sounds like some sort of evil villain in one of my kids' TV shows. So this is about so the longstanding, we're talking decades, issues about whether U.S. pork and beef is also an issue should be allowed into Taiwan. And in particular, concerns about ractopamine. These are additives that are allowed in the United States and generally not in Taiwan. But it's so much more than about the science. And I respect that people want to be cautious about what they are ingesting. But this is a lot about local business, local farmers, a lot about finger pointing between the KMT and DPP. So I find it personally very hard to figure out how much the resistance of people is because of the actual health concerns and how much there are political games that have been going on so long. And certainly even the KMT, they flip-flopped on their position depending on whether this was an issue that they thought they could score some points in digging at Tsai Ing-wen or if they were in power. But more with respect to U.S.-Taiwan relations, and I think it's really important to point out that right now Taiwan is, I think, the U.S.'s ninth largest trading partner. It fluctuates to a little bit. And for Tsai Ing-wen to make this overture of saying that she is willing to relax the standards and willing to allow more imports was a big sign. And I think what we want to see is hopefully with the new USTR, Catherine Tai, that she will be more interested than Lighthizer in looking to revamp and update the U.S.-Taiwan trade relationship. It's not hard to be more interested in doing that than Lighthizer because he didn't even give Taiwan the time of day. That's one thing we're watching here.
It's so funny because Lighthizer... He had these quotes being like, oh, God, like, I can't believe I'm spending this much time in Beijing. It's such a terrible city. Like, he should have just spent some time in Taipei. It's lovely there.
The reason pork is so controversial, though, is like there's two kind of big reasons. First, you know, Taiwan has wanted an FTA with the U.S. for a long time. And agricultural trade has been the starting point, and the U.S. will not continue talks until agriculture is a deal. So, you know, in 2012, Ma Ying-jeou, the former president, pushed through Racto Beef, which back then the DPP adamantly opposed for the same reasons that the KMT now opposes the DPP wanting Racto Pork, which is, you know, kind of what Maggie means by, you know, depending on the time of day and the year and who's in power, people will either be for or against this, depending on political points. But Ma could not get pork through. And in order to start FTA talks, the U.S. wanted both beef and pork. So this pork deal is kind of the big barrier that Taiwan has been trying to get through in order to start having a productive discussion about some, you know, whether it's an FTA or just some sort of bilateral trade deal with the U.S. Tsai is really kind of, you know, using a lot of her political capital on this move. So right now, she's very popular because of Taiwan's very good COVID response, and people are generally happy with her administration. And she's kind of, you know, gotten a lot of chips in her corner, and she's spending a lot of those chips on pork because Taiwanese take pork really seriously. And it's not just because of, you know, think about the health of our kids. Pork is one of the biggest industries in Taiwan. And by saying that we're going to start bringing in American pork, you're essentially saying we're going to create competition for domestic farmers when we don't really need domestic competition for our farmers. They're doing just fine as is. But she has to in order to get this deal started. So she's having to sell this really kind of strange deal to people that they didn't really want, but will need if they want to have a bigger trade deal with the U.S. And unfortunately, the timing of it did not go nearly as smoothly as I'm sure Tsai wished, because Tsai didn't. So there's been no kind of immediate reciprocity from the U.S. Like, the U.S. hasn't suddenly given Taiwan any sort of deal back yet. It's more Tsai relaxed this, is allowing U.S. pork in, and people are asking, well, what did we get? And she doesn't have anything to show yet. And this has made her a kind of easy, this has made the issue an easy target, especially for the KMT, who's currently in opposition and really looking for anything they can to throw against Tsai. Because when your government prevents a pandemic from spreading, it's pretty hard to attack them for that, which is why the KMT has been struggling to find things to critique Tsai on these days. But this pork thing, they are zeroing in on it and you know, taking it to the streets and protesting over pork and remobilizing everyone who voted for Han Kuo-yu back in 2020. And I fully expect American pork. I know, like, it seems the idea of pork being such an important political issue might seem silly from the outside, but really it's not. It's so much more than just, you know, pork. It's about, you know, the future of Taiwan domestic markets, you know, making deals that, you know, really help Taiwan in the long term, and trying to show people that this is more of a, you know, long-term strategy. And it's something that's going to stay relevant in Taiwanese politics at least through the midterm, if not longer.
Sure. So you mentioned the KMT earlier. Let's come back to them. What are the sort of like potential paths that that party, the current opposition party, could go down in trying to rebrand and get themselves back more in the electoral graces of the Taiwanese electorate? And where do you think, you know, if you were sitting in the, you know, the smoky back room, what would you be telling them to do in this upcoming midterm?
Yeah, the KMT is looking for its next act, and it hasn't figured out what that is. So the last presidential election, their candidate, Han Kuo-yu, was not your typical KMT candidate, right? He was mayor of Kaohsiung, but when he was sent down to run for mayor of Kaohsiung, I don't know, what do you think Vegas odds were at? It was really bad that there hasn't been a KMT mayor of Kaohsiung. And
the expectation was like Trump winning the presidency in 2016.
But he did, and I, you know, shout out to Nathan Batto at Academia Sinica, who's done some really good work on looking at the role of populism in Han Kuo-yu's rise, first as mayor of Kaohsiung and then as the presidential candidate for the KMT. But then he also had a stellar loss. I mean, he lost decidedly, and we knew the results within a few hours, which was spectacular. You know, don't take for granted a clean, fair, and swift election. But so once that fell away, I think it emboldened some of the more old school KMT people to say, look, that wasn't the white knight, and, you know, on the horse that was going to save the KMT. Maybe we should listen more to the Ma Ying-jeou era. But you also have a younger generation of KMT, more in their 40s, who are trying to pull away from sort of the 92 consensus, or so-called 92 consensus of that was the KMT and the CCP, kind of agreeing to disagree, but at least that there is a something called China. And they're realizing that's a non-starter for a framework for most people here. And then you have some people in the KMT who are looking also as not your traditional KMT, that I think the most likely person that I see coming up is Ho Youyi. So Ho Youyi is currently the mayor of New Taipei City, Xinbei Shi, which is right next to Taipei, and used to be part of the county, and was reorganized as a separate city. He's really interesting. He was a police officer during the martial law era, and then he switched over to politics. He's doing, by all accounts, a great job as far as being very popular in New Taipei. I think he's one that I'm watching, certainly, as we look forward to 2024.
I think something that's really important to look back on when we look at the 2020 election, you know, like Maggie said, Hong Kong definitely lost, but it wasn't a sweeping defeat for the KMT as a whole. So I think there's two important numbers to look at. So Hong Kong got 5.5 million votes. Tsai Ing-wen got 8.2 million votes. So of course he lost. But if you compare that to the last election, Zhu Lilun, when he ran against Tsai, only got 3.5 million votes. So even though Han lost, he was able to mobilize 2 million more voters for the KMT. And then if you look at the party vote, so very quickly, when you vote in Taiwan, you vote three times. You vote for your president, you vote for your district representative, and then you vote for whichever party you like the most. It's a hybrid system that is kind of a mix between the U.S. and Germany. The KMT actually tied the DPP in the party vote. So both the DPP and the KMT got 33% of the total party vote. Now, this tells us that, you know, if you look at the news and headlines and if you look at the actual outcome of the election, the DPP still won overwhelmingly when it came to district races. And the DPP is still the majority in the legislative yuan. But what these two numbers tell me is that the KMT is most certainly hurting, but it's not gone. And when I look at the way that the KMT has been able to mobilize its base of support over Ractopork, and I look at how even with a absolute losing candidate like Hong Guoyu, they were still able to turn out as much as they did. I don't think, you know, if they can find that winning candidate, I do not think that it is, you know, beyond the realm of possibility that the KMT can make a comeback in Taiwan. Because Tsai and the DPP are so popular now, we kind of very quickly write them off. But, you know, under the right circumstances, you know, there's still a chance. And so, you know, looking, you know, forward, you know, obviously Hoyoi, but, you know, you have other, you know, young potentials like the great-grandson of Chiang Kai-shek, Jiang Wan-an, who is currently a legislator, who is the direct great-grandson of Chiang Kai-shek, who I think is also being vetted as a potential future KMT leader.
Are there any women on the bench for the KMT?
Well, they tried in Kaohsiung.
In 2016, the 2016 presidential election, if you remember, the KMT had a woman candidate, Hong Xiu-zhu, who was so bad, they actually withdrew her and put Zhu Lilun in her place at the last minute. There are women in the KMT with leadership roles. They just do not currently lead any of the major factions. And, you know, one fun fact, you know, people always ask, are there any young KMT supporters? They exist. There's not many of them. But there's actually two local Taipei city councilors under the age of 30 who are both women from the KMT.
And just more generally, because so often you see the, you know, Tsai Ing-wen, the first female president, and thankfully now that we're, you know, 5 years into her being president, that's dropped away. But it is complicated to be a woman in politics here. And there's a lot of misogyny. And some of that is thinly veiled. Some of it comes out just full force. And so even though in many ways women have done, you know, very well, and not only Tsai Ing-wen, but you had Annette Liu as vice president under Chen Shui-bian, it's still difficult. So those issues have not been resolved.
And you see the number that, like, you know, a large percentage of Taiwanese politicians are women, and Taiwan brags about that, which they should, because it's a good thing. But that's also legally mandated that parties have X percentage women on their candidate lists, and certain percentages of those who run have to be of fair gender representation.
Do you know what those numbers?
It's good that it's built in the system, but building it into the system doesn't make misogyny go away.
18-year-old voter referendum. What are the dynamics behind that?
So this is one of those issues that seemingly every political party is in favor of, which is good because it seems like the KMT has finally figured out they need young voters, and, you know, being supportive of lowering the age to 18 might seem like a good idea. Unfortunately, I don't think there's going to be any 18-year-olds voting for the KMT because young people, especially under the age of 40, overwhelmingly do not support the KMT. In fact, most people under the age of 40 have nothing good to say about the KMT and overwhelmingly support either the DPP or a third party. And it's really as someone who's, I study third parties in Taiwan, so that's really my main interest. Third parties have a particular small advantage in Taiwan relative to, say, like the U.S. because of that party vote. If this was America, if there's a Democrat and a Republican running and you don't like either of them and you really like the Green Party, but there's no way that, you know, the Green Party candidate's ever going to win in your district, you can write in Green Party on your party vote and then, you know, they have a chance at getting some representation. And that's really been the secret behind third party success in Taiwan. And young people who overwhelmingly support third parties more than older voters, if there's essentially two additional cohorts joining in the voting population, that's going to give third parties an even bigger base of support to draw from. And same with the DVP. The DVP has become incredibly popular among younger voters again. You know, they were always popular, but during, you know, the Sunflower Movement to 2016, you know, there was a bit of a dip where young voters would prefer third parties over the DPP. And currently the DPP has successfully kind of managed to be cool and young and hip again. And they've really gotten a lot of in a way that the KMT just absolutely cannot figure out. The DPP has actually appealed to young voters in a really, really productive way that's really brought in a lot of support back. The 18-year-old voting change is really just going to open up, you know, more cohorts of voters that these parties are going to be fighting over. And we know currently that it's going to be advantage to third parties and the DPP. So it's really a matter of will the DPP and third parties really just reap all the benefits, or will the KMT be able to figure some way to appeal to the kids?
Lev, do you want to give us a bit of a tour of the third party universe? Which are the ones that you've find most interesting? Of
going back to that number that I said, you know, in 2020, 33% went to the DPP, 33% of the party vote went to the KMT, 33% of the vote went to third parties. So, you know, third parties are not something to be, you know, very quickly written off in Taiwan, because they actually have seats, and they actually can make a pretty big difference in elections here. So, you know, there's currently three third parties that have representation. The first is called the Taiwan People Party, Taiwan People's Party, Taiwan Minzhongdang. It is started by the Mayor Ko Wen-je, who was originally a independent and then later started his own political party. They currently have, I believe, 11 legislatures in the Legislative Yuan.
But their momentum seems to not be growing.
Oh, sure. Like there's something to be said. Currently, all three represented small parties in the Li Fa Yuan do not have good momentum right now. A lot of their support is going either back to the DPP or to the KMT. But Ko Wen-je's party is not a particularly green party. It actually is. I would describe Ko Wen-je's party as more light blue, in the sense where they're not pro-China in the unabashed way that the KMT often is, but they're far more sympathetic to the idea of creating relations with China in a way that green voters are not. So Ko Wen-je's infamous line, he says, "Liang an yi jia qin," which got him in a lot of hot water with green voters, because that's, you know, two sides of the straight one family is not something that a lot of people who are pro-Taiwan really sympathize with.
And actually, their color is teal. So if you're going to be somewhere between the green and blue, spectrum, I guess they got out their paints and mixed them up.
Yeah. So the other party currently in is called the New Power Party, and they're a party that formed out of the Sunflower Movement after the 2014's social protest, the Sunflower Movement. And the New Power Party had representation in 2016. They did very well in their first election, and they did just as well in their second election. They currently have three people in office right now. They're a directly pro-independence party. They say directly, we support Taiwanese independence. They're highly critical of relations with China, highly critical of the PRC. And they're also very highly critical of the DPP, which gets them in a lot of hot water with pro-Taiwan voters. Because this is really the tough balance that third parties have to kind of market themselves as, is because the DPP is such an important institution for pro-Taiwan voters. You know, the DPP is the very first opposition party in Taiwan, started by social activists, you know, in opposition to the KMT's brutal authoritarian martial law era. And the DPP holds special meaning for a lot of pro-Taiwan voters. But there are people that are not happy with the DPP and they want other choices. And so that's why you often have people like the New Power Party coming out. But unfortunately, the New Power Party has to do a very complicated balancing act of both criticizing the DPP in a way that makes the NPP stand out while not being overly critical of the DPP and isolating a lot of green voters. So finally, the third party third party is called the Taiwan State Building Party. And they only have one person who won in an absolute mind-blowing defeat. He won in a Taichung in a very, very deep blue district. I assumed he was going to lose. I didn't even give him the time of day. Because he ran in perhaps like the most obvious going to lose district, and he won in places when other candidates I had odds on winning all lost, he was the one that out of nowhere won. Now, the Taiwan State Building Party is actually a pretty old organization. They've just changed their name like four or five times. But as a political party, they're relatively new on the scene. They also are overtly pro-Taiwan independence, but they're much more closely aligned with the DPP in terms of willing to work with the DPP than the NPP are.
And even with the state building, the Jijindang, that I remember last year when I was here with a group around the election, and we met with a representative just to get a better sense of, you know, how did they identify themselves? What made them different? Why weren't they just part of the DPP? And my sense, there was at least the person we spoke with, quite a bit of pragmatism that, you know, we're not saying that we think tomorrow that Taiwan is going to declare sovereignty under the name Taiwan. But, you know, of course, this place is functionally independent right now. It's a question of under what name. But they said, we want that to be part of the conversation. We don't want the status quo moderate view that's under Tsai to make it so we don't have that voice of the people who at least want to keep this as a viable part of what's being discussed.
And that's really an important point. These third parties that are overtly pro-independence, they see the DPP and Tsai Ing-wen as pro-status quo, which is not a bad thing. But a lot of the way that, you know, a lot of China watchers see the DPP and Tsai Ing-wen as this, you know, crazy pro-independence woman who's trying to provoke China, that's just not true. Tsai's actually criticized often by those who are deeper green for not being pro-independence enough, and that the DPP is not pro-independence enough. And that Tsai is actually very pragmatic when it comes to how she refers to Taiwan, Taiwan's future, Taiwan's goals. You know, she says in almost all of her speeches where she has to speak on to where Taiwan fits internationally as the Republic of China. Sometimes she says Republic of China, Taiwan. Sometimes she just says Republic of China. But she is not the rabble rouser that she often gets portrayed as.
So, what are some of the social issues you guys are following?
One of the issues that, again, it feels like a long time ago, but it wasn't that long ago that Taiwan legalized same-sex marriage. And that was really interesting because, at least for me, I'm a lawyer, so I think courts are important. And this was a time that the Constitutional Court was very important because the Constitutional Court had said, government, you must legalize same-sex marriage. It's a constitutional issue. And unlike the United States, where the Supreme Court says it and it has to happen then, one mechanism the court has here is to give a runway, to say, we're giving you here, you know, year or two to figure it out. And if not, there's going to be a default that people are going to have to be able to marry. And so then you had these really complex machinations between the executive branch and the legislature. And finally, a law was passed. Interestingly, it didn't say flat out same-sex marriage. It had this Article 3 relationship. They tried to couch it in more palatable language because the DPP, even though it has progressive in its name, actually has a lot of older, traditionally more conservative values people in its midst who were not comfortable with same-sex marriage. But it did pass, and we've since seen a more overt embracing. There's always been a big gay pride parade. It was huge this year, especially given that other countries couldn't have that kind of gathering. And now we're seeing moves to expand who can engage in same-sex marriage, because it was limited as far as if someone was not Taiwanese, whether that was able to happen. And we're starting to see legal movement to make it so even if one of the people is not Taiwanese, there's some limits, that's open. I'm watching family building as far as being able to adopt outside the relationship and other reproductive technologies that have not been available necessarily easily to single women. But also just generally watching how Hong Kong is going so, it's so sad. You know, day by day, we look at the civil and political rights just being demolished by Beijing. And so that being here in Taiwan, especially given the close ties amongst, and Lev can speak more to this, between Hong Kong and Taiwan, makes me all the more appreciate the ability to assemble, to associate, free expression, never take any of these fundamental human rights for granted.
Sure.
Yeah, so Hong Kong became a major issue in Taiwan, of course, like it became in many parts of the world once the protests broke out starting in 2019. And, you know, it most certainly was an important factor for the 2020 election. Not the only factor is a hill that I've died on, because a lot of people very quickly try to say that Tsai's massive victory was because of Hong Kong, and I disagree with that. But it most certainly mattered. And, you know, Hong Kong became a part of the conversation in Taiwan in a way that it has not before. You know, there have been multiple solidarity rallies. There's a lot of public support and saying, like, you know, Taiwan stands with Hong Kong. Taiwan even went so far as to open a humanitarian office to help Hong Kongers. But, you know, when you look a little bit deeper into the policy behind, you know, what's really being helped here, you find that, you know, even though they opened this really cool sounding office that seems to signal this great sense of solidarity, the office is a little bit unknown. Like, we don't really know how many people are able to utilize it. And the language that, you know, some of these, like, pro-Hong Kong policies use is, like, you know, if we absolutely welcome Hong Kongers who are looking to come to Taiwan, especially if they're wealthy and can invest, and we'll give special tax breaks to them. And if, you know, they have high-tech skills, we'll help them find employment. And this is all wonderful and nice, but, you know, the concern was, you know, people who really needed to get to Taiwan were those who are, you know, young protesters who, you know, face political persecution. And a lot of the policies that Taiwan was putting out while in support of Hong Kong were not really addressing, you know, how is Taiwan going to help those most in need? And, you know, we hear stories here and there about, you know, Hong Kongers being smuggled in by boat. You know, there is a story over the summer about five Hong Kongers who were smuggled here, and we just recently learned that they've been relocated to the U.S. But more recently, there's a story of the 12 Hong Kongers who tried to flee to Taiwan by boat and were caught by the Coast Guard. And, you know, really, you know, they're now held in China, and, you know, we have not really heard clear details about their situation.
Caught by the Chinese Coast Guard.
Yes. And so, you know, the reason that this is upsetting to me, you know, is at least Taiwan has signaled that if you are a protester or someone who fears political persecution, Taiwan is not going to directly help you. But if you can get to Taiwan, we'll help you under the radar. Now, that might seem fine, but that really creates a really dangerous incentive structure in which you're kind of signaling that young Hong Kongers who were protesters, who have already put themselves at immense risk, ought to put themselves at even further risk just to get to potentially maybe get to Taiwan and potentially.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard, though, Lev. Like, what are they going to do? Are they going to, like have bring submarines and, like, have people sneak onto them? I mean, it's a question that doesn't have a good answer.
They could write them
visas,
right? Well, so the example is there's this case of Tony Chung. So Tony Chung actually tried to apply through. So Tony Chung is a protester who was arrested prosecuted. And you know, he applied through the Hong Kong Humanitarian Aid Office and was rejected. And that's upsetting because now he's in jail.
I mean, it's
so
it's,
you know, it's cases like that where you know, and some people point to saying Tsai can't go too far. She can't, you know, if she starts bringing Hong Kong protesters over, that's going to really upset Beijing. And maybe, but I, you know, given, you know, that they're willing to bring Hong Kongers over and by other means, I don't know if I necessarily agree or buy that argument. It really seems to me more that there's very little public demand. At least on the Taiwan side, that people don't seem the need to pressure Tsai or the DPP into bringing more Hong Kongers over here. It just is. It's one of those things where I think overwhelmingly people here will say that they support Hong Kong and support the protests. But whether or not they really are invested in trying to help bring Hong Kongers to Taiwan, I think is a different issue.
I mean, it's so hard because, like, okay, fine. They give that guy the visa and the police will take him off the plane. So it's not like, even if Tsai does the most aggressive version of this, those people will have an easier time of, you know, an easier time getting away from the, sort of clutches of the Hong Kong police, because, you know, I can certainly see a way in which this develops and where they sort of have someone standing outside. I'm sure they already do have someone standing outside of wherever you get your visa, your Taiwan visa in Hong Kong, and like writing those folks' names down and accelerating whatever sort of pseudo judicial process is going on to bring cases against these folks. So I don't know. I mean, it's certainly a bummer that there isn't more enthusiasm, it seems, for this within the Taiwanese electorate, but I don't think Tsai sort of rhetorically or even on a statutory level, like opening the doors more broadly would really make all that much difference in that many people's lives, sadly. I don't know. What's your take, Maggie?
I feel like Tsai's job involves a lot of decisions with not great choices. It's an extremely difficult thing to be president of Republic of China, parentheses, Taiwan, when you have, you do have this existential threat, and that's an overused phrase, but that is exactly what Taiwan faces. And having the deterioration of rights and the political situation in Hong Kong, I think it's just made that all the more apparent. Because for years, there's been a discussion here about how there is a lack of a refugee law. And that discussion in the past, it's partially about Hong Kong, but just more generally, you know, what do you do when there are people who are seeking to flee someplace because they're being persecuted. And there are concerns here about having too much in the way of immigration, though certainly there's a lot of people here temporarily, particularly from Southeast Asia, who are working a lot of times with elder care and, you know, big issues as far as their labor rights and whether they are adequately protected. So it's bigger than just about people coming from Hong Kong. But the layer two, that there is a law that has to do with relations with Hong Kong and Macau, because that's thrown in. And there is an article in there which talks about providing assistance. But because of the unusual status between Hong Kong and Taiwan, it's certainly not state-to-state relations, that adds another layer of complexity to an issue about refugees, which is already politically fraught.
There's no transition, but we're going to do one more beat about music. Lev and Maggie, what have you guys been listening to recently in terms of Taiwanese artists?
I've been following Taiwan's music scene for a while, and I think there's just a totally unappreciated, untapped market for great talent coming out of Taiwan. And there's so much good music here. You know, one of the really cool things about being here right now is that this is like the one place in the world where you can still go to music festivals, which, you know, not to rub salt in the wound, but...
Rub it in.
I'm going to... I'll get closer to the mic. Two music festivals in the next month. Because I can, it's a whole range. Maggie just brought up Abao, who's this great Taiwanese indigenous singer, so Paiwanzu, she's really great because she just won she swept like almost every award at Taiwan's Music Awards this year, which is really cool because one, she's an indigenous singer; two, she sings in Taiwanese. And she had this really great quote in an interview that I really loved where, the song, Despacito, that was really popular all over the world for a long time, which is in Spanish. And I don't speak Spanish, and I'm fairly certain a lot of people who really love that song also don't speak Spanish and don't really understand it. And Abao referred to her music, in the same way that, she hopes people appreciate Despacito or have appreciated Despacito. She hopes that people can listen to her music and appreciate it in the same way, even if they don't understand what she's saying, that they can still, feel something towards the music in a similar way.
And she'll mix several languages in a single song. And one thing we haven't talked about is that Taiwan has a significant indigenous population, a number of different groups, different languages. And in addition to dealing with its authoritarian martial law passed and transitional justice that is ongoing to address that time, there's also ongoing issues about addressing how the indigenous populations have been harmed by, you know, the KMT under martial law, by the Japanese colonial rule, and even more recently since democratization. So especially with all the sad and heart-rending news coming out of Xinjiang and other places, it's also nice to see a place where there's some grappling with, even if a lot of work left to do with respect to the indigenous groups.
For political science nerds, you know, it's really interesting to see how votes play out within Taiwan's indigenous groups because they overwhelmingly support the KMT when it comes to the polls, which goes against what a lot of people would think. Why would indigenous groups that have been historically marginalized and oppressed still vote for the KMT, who many people here, you know, still view as, you know, the former colonizer of Taiwan? There's a long explanation, and, you know, there's a history of, you know, fraught relations between the DPP and indigenous groups as well. But you're starting to see a new change where younger indigenous voters are starting to vote green and support the DPP while you still have most older voters supporting the KMT.
So I've had a few conversations with like young college age China Talk listeners in the past year about like what they should do with their, you know, COVID lives. And I've been telling everyone to just go to Taiwan. What is the status in terms of like folks being able to show up for programs and whatnot as of January 28th, 2021?
I am delighted to say that both Lev and I, we were both Fulbrighters here in Taiwan. Fulbright program is very large here. It has everywhere from people who have just graduated from undergrad and are coming over as ETAs, English teaching assistants, and working at schools, elementary schools throughout Taiwan, to the senior scholars. We're senior, but not necessarily old. And so I'd really recommend looking at Fulbright. And we actually have more people coming than we expected, because the Trump administration shut down Fulbright Hong Kong and China programs, which I think was the stupidest decision. I hope Biden will be able to move that back in the other direction soon. So Fulbright's great. There's a lot of other language programs. People are still coming over. As I said, some Fulbrighters are, I think, in quarantine right now. And more generally, even as hopefully we pull out of the worst of the pandemic, Taiwan is a fantastic place for language learning. And it had, in the 90s, there was such a shift, and even starting in the 80s, towards learning Chinese in China. And I went to Beijing. And Lev, you never actually studied in China, did you?
No, I did. I lived in China for 2.5 years.
Oh, of course, you were at Hong Kong.
But
your initial your language study was here, though.
Yeah, no. So I came to Taiwan first,
which is for you youngins, that was unusual.
It's very unusual. Most people go to China.
But we're going to see, I think, more and more of a shift coming back here because of not just health and pollution and other kind of quality of life, but the freedom, academic freedom is such a wonderful thing to have, and you realize how it has been squeezed increasingly. I love Star Wars. It's the trash compactor is getting smaller and smaller as far as academic freedom. And Hopkins, Nanjing, where we both went, I think is one of the few libraries where it's still whatever books they want, at least last I checked. So I'd say, too, that universities in the U.S. should be increasingly looking to send more students here.
A little contrarian take. I don't necessarily see, having done a graduate level program in China, not having academic freedom, I don't think it impacted me all that much. First off, like, the paper you write in grad school or, you know, for your semester abroad is not going to change the world. And, you know, you can always just read the books. You have a VPN. You can do the research. And you are unlikely to, you know, very unlikely to get in trouble as a young person if all you're doing is reading stuff online. You know, there's something very different from, you know, necessarily, like, clearly there are certain topics that if you wanted to do active research on, you could get yourself in trouble by. But I guess I'm saying, like, as a student, if you're, you know, spending a chunk of time on the mainland, the fact that your professors aren't going to assign you certain books or, you know, won't let you write about certain topics, or, you know, the library might not have, you know, Tombstone or whatever in it, I don't think has like as big a lasting effect as necessarily, you know, maybe if you're a more established academic and like all of a sudden you have to sort of like live in a Chinese academic system. I think that's where you see a major impact. I don't know.
I think it matters. Maybe because I'm a professor and I'd like to think that who's teaching you matters and what they can say. But I think the conversations first in the classroom are going to be different. And also everything's fine until it's not. I was in Beijing when the Canadians, Michael Kovering and Spavor, were taken in, and there was a collective sucking in of air, kind of like, whoa, this is game changing. So I don't want to assume, especially given what we've seen in Hong Kong and that academic freedom is the same as even if it was a couple years ago in China, and also the opportunities outside of the classroom. I was just at a conference here that was put together by a group of defense lawyers, and it was all about, you know, what are the obligations to get evidence, give it to the government, and what do we require the government to give us? And you know, Lev's going to protests all the time, so the learning outside the classroom too. So yeah. And you don't have to have it one or the other. I mean, ideally, people would go both places and be comfortable in seeing and making their own decisions about what those two countries are.
I mean, shout out to the Hopkins Nanjing Center, but you know, for me, it wasn't just about reading the books. Like, if you're only going to grad school to read books, then you're wasting your money. For me, you know, and I think for a lot of people, it's about the experience and the conversations you have with people. And part of the reason academic freedom was very special at Hopkins Nanjing is because it kind of guaranteed both, you know, Chinese my Chinese student colleagues and the other international students a safe space where we know we can talk about topics without having to have, you know, a fear of, you know, potential pushback even from the administration. So
yeah, and you know, I think Maggie, like, studying protests and you know, living in a democracy and reading polls and seeing like different news outlets that like disagree with each other is remarkable. You know, the first time I went to Taiwan, I remember walking down the street and seeing banners in Mandarin of people saying like, you know, screw the government, and was kind of blown away because it's something that I hadn't been exposed to in my first you know, year and a half engaging with the language. So I agree.
It's a different country.
It's a different country. But I will say that, like, I think if you want to be someone who understands mainland China, it is important to go to mainland China. Even if you know, even if you sort of you have to you know, clip your wings a little bit. You know, folks who've listened to this podcast for a while will probably notice that the topics I have started to cover after I realized I wasn't going back anytime soon have shifted. And I don't even know if I would be having this conversation with you guys if I was, you know, if I was still living in Beijing. So it's...
And ideally, you have people who are familiar with both. And this is one thing I'm looking to see with the Biden administration, is that understandably, people who have their dominant experience being studying, living and understanding China, they're going to see Taiwan differently than people who have significant in-country experience here. And so you want to have a mix of people and those experiences so they can look at the issues from different viewpoints.
And, you know, it's really wonderful, you know, one more shout out to Fulbright that, you know, even though Taiwan is an imperfect place to do Chinese research, it is better than not. So, you know, I have very dear friends who were supposed to go to Fulbright China this year, PhD students who had their entire PhD academic careers planned out and then thoroughly thrown in their faces by the Trump administration. You know, getting Fulbright as a PhD student is a big deal, and we don't get many things to celebrate, but that's certainly something to celebrate. So getting that pulled out from underneath your feet really sucks. And the fact that Taiwan Fulbright made special effort to accommodate China PhDs who wanted to come to Taiwan instead, you know, I think that really puts a new spin on just what can be done if you're an academic trying to do some sort of research in China or Taiwan.
Lev and Maggie, thanks so much for coming on China Talk.
Yay, Fulbright.
Yay, Fulbright, yeah.
Thank you.
They pay us to say that, but no, they don't. Thank you.
Hey there, China Talk listeners. This is Tracy Alloway.
And I'm Jill Wiesenthal, and we are the co-hosts of Bloomberg's Oddlots podcast.
Yep, and if you enjoy China Talk, we think that you'll like Oddlots too.
We have engaging conversations on everything from semiconductors to trade to AI to macroeconomic policy, and we always have the perfect guest.
Yep, you can check us out at Oddlots on all the podcast platforms or Bloomberg.com/Oddlots.